Yeah, leave it on. It's good just fine.
Good evening and welcome to the regular meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board for the City of Morro Bay. Today is Thursday, April 3rd, 2014. It's 6:02 p.m. We do have quorum. All members except for Alan are present at the moment, so we're expecting him shortly. So the meeting is hereby called to order. We'll start with the moment of silence. Thank you, and we'll move on to the Pledge of Allegiance. Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And we will now move on to advisory board member announcements and presentations. We'll start over to my left with Jean.
I have none.
All right. Lynn?
None.
I don't have any tonight. We'll keep going down the line here. Dana?
Yes, I will report on the 8th annual Big Rock Regatta, which we had not last weekend, but the weekend before. We had 2 days of racing, 10 races. We had a record of 71 boats, and being that we're the most northerly of the yachting association that puts this series together, we also get people from San Francisco. So it was a huge success, and we look forward to next year.
Thank you, Dana. And I would add to that, this is the first time I had an opportunity to serve on a race committee boat, and it was really a fun event. Very well attended, puts Morro Bay on the map. So congratulations to the Yacht Club and all the recreational boaters that participated. A wonderful event for our community. I'll go back over. Let the record reflect, please, that Alan is here. And, Alan, we are at advisory board member announcements and presentations. Do you have any announcements for us tonight?
No.
All right. Thank you, Alan. And down to Ron.
Two announcements. One is a reminder that Saturday and Sunday is the 2014 annual citywide Morro Bay yard sale, beloved by many, despised by a few for traffic issues. And Morro Bay, it's sponsored by Morro Bay Beautiful, and the Sun Bulletin was a great deal of help, and you will find, if you're interested, a map of some of the participating yard sale sellers in the current issue of the Sun Bulletin. And
you mean Bay News?
Thanks, Bay News. Thank you. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I can hear Neil calling me right now. So. And my wife, when I get home, will discuss this with me as well. The second thing, I'd like to give a little report on the activities of the Morro Bay Marine Services Facility Ad Hoc Committee since the last Harbor Advisory Board meeting. The principal activity focuses around Lisa Wise Consulting, Inc., providing a targeted proposal for a market demand analysis for the Marine Services Facility. That was an element of a larger proposal that was previously supplied by Lisa Wise Consulting to the Morro Bay Fishermen's Commercial Fishermen's Organization. But that's been refined somewhat, and the committee reviewed, the ad hoc committee reviewed that proposal, and the essence of it the board has in front of it this evening. And the city asked, by that I mean city leadership, asked the Harbor Advisory Board to provide them with a recommendation specific to this particular proposal, which is, I would say, phase one of what was of the previously larger scope proposal. So I'm prepared to offer a motion relative to that recommendation, the Harbor Advisory Board recommendation, if the board so pleases.
Okay. Okay, so before we go on, Ron, are there any questions at all for Ron with regard to the ad hoc committee meeting or process? No? And if you'd like to offer a motion, we'll entertain it.
Sure. Move that the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board recommend to the City of Morro Bay that the city agree to 50% participation in funding Lisa Wise Consulting, Inc.'s March 27, 2014 proposal entitled, quote, Proposal for Boatyard and Haul-Out Market Analysis, end quote. Further recommend that the city acquaint itself with the proposed methodology of the market demand analysis and that the city pursue accelerating the analysis timeline as Lisa Wise Consulting suggested might be possible. They suggested that after they submitted their proposal.
I would second the motion.
All right. The motion has been moved and seconded. I see that Ron does have it written down over there, Polly, so it was a little lengthy, so it's there. Yes, Eric.
Yeah, good evening. If I may attempt to be a wet blanket, one of my favorite roles, can we take action on this since we're not since we don't have it on the agenda?
You know, I was thinking the same thing. Well, he was reading the motion. Since it is under presentations and it's an ongoing work of the ad hoc committee, we did pass a motion last month. This looks to me to be... So we've already expressed the board's desire in this, and it looks to me a refinement of that. We're not changing direction. We're not... I agree with you, Eric. I think if we were having a vote to overturn or take a different direction... I would agree with you. I think that would need to be a separately agendized item. But as this is an ongoing item, I feel it's okay if you feel it's okay.
Well, I'm going to lean on you.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's. I believe it's within the scope of the ongoing work of the ad hoc committee. And again, it's a follow-up item to something that the board has already expressed their will upon. So as chair, I'm fine with it. Is the body fine with it? Does anybody have any problems with...
I agree that it's a clarification of a previous recommendation by the ad hoc committee, then also recommended by our board, the Harbor Advisory Board, at our previous meeting. This is just a clarification of the study, as far as the analysis
Bill,
particulars.
When you say clarification, last month's meeting was to authorize $32,000 for this study. If what Ron is stating here, he mentioned 50% of the total cost. As I look at this piece of paper here, it looks like the total cost is $30,000. Is that correct? So 50% of that would be $15,000. So are you now stating that the $32,000 has been reduced and you'd like to make it down to about $15,000? Is that correct?
Yes, but only by virtue of this being phase one of a larger scope. Yes, the budget for this, as presented for this market demand analysis element of the larger scope, as presented by Lisa Wise Consulting, is $29,000. So the motion addresses a 50% participation in the $29,000 by the City of Morro Bay.
So I ask, and maybe Eric would be the one, where did this $32,000 go? What did the city council recommend, or is that still has that been decided at all?
To date, the council has not taken action on this specific item. We've got on next week's agenda consideration of the fishing community sustainability plan, which we reviewed a few months ago. One of the elements of that, one of the primary recommendations out of that is boatyard and haul out, further feasibility and other studies to pursue that. So depending on what kind of action the council takes on that, we do have it up in front of the council next week for consideration. So that's where they'll take your motions and the ad hoc committee's recommendations into consideration.
And Ron, would you do us a favor and just reread the motion once more, please, because it is a little lengthy. I want to make sure we completely understand what we're discussing.
Sure. move that the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board recommend to the City of Morro Bay that the city agree to 50% participation in funding Lisa Wise Consulting, Inc.'s March 27, 2014 proposal entitled, quote, Proposal for Boatyard and Haulout Market Analysis, end quote. Further, recommend that the city acquaint itself with the proposed methodology of the market demand analysis and that the city pursue accelerating the analysis timeline, as Lisa Wise Consulting, Inc. has suggested may be possible.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so in listening as closely as I could, it's we're almost just restating last month's motion, except with a little bit of refinement to it, and no real material change in direction, which could cause a problem. So any further discussion? Gene?
Yeah, I'm not reading this yet, but is Lisa White's proposal for $29,000 for half of the work, basically?
No, Lisa Wise Consulting's current proposal, March 27, not to be confused with the previous proposal of March 12, which was a larger scope. The March 27 proposal focused just on a market demand analysis, as opposed to any other elements of the issue, is for $29,000.
Okay.
In total.
In total.
In total.
And you're asking the city to cough up half of that?
Well, not asking the city, but the ad hoc committee
is recommending
to the city that they cough up half of that, yes.
And this is okay with Lisa White's consulting firm and the Commercial Fishermen's Association? I know you're trying to do the whole thing. That's what
Lisa Wise Consulting agreed readily, I would say, to refining their March 14 proposal or 12 proposal to focus on the market demand analysis.
So that's the scope of work.
Yes, and the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization is represented by two of its board members on the ad hoc committee. So I can't speak for the whole organization, but the two fishermen who are on the ad hoc committee, who are on the board of the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization, want this to move forward.
Okay. I have no problems with the motion as long as it meets Robert Rules of Order things.
Okay. Ellen?
Gene, you did bring up one interesting point, that it's $29,000 for the market demand analysis. I would not say that's half of the original proposed study. So we don't know what that's going to do to the cost of the entire study.
Any further discussion? All right. I'm going to reread the motion once more, please, Ron. The motion was moved by Ron, seconded by Dana. We'll restate the motion, and then we'll move to a vote.
Move that the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board recommend to the City of Morro Bay that the city agree to 50% participation in funding Lisa Wise Consulting, Inc.'s March 27, 2014 proposal entitled, quote, Proposal for Boatyard and Haulout Market Analysis, end quote. Further, recommend that the city acquaint itself with proposed methodology, the market demand analysis, and that the city pursue accelerating the analysis timeline, as Lisa Wise Consulting has suggested may be possible.
All right. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? There's none opposed. So it carries unanimously. Any other announcements or presentations by board members? Yes, Bill.
I had a meeting with Becca. It's Becca, correct, Eric? And we've decided on a May 17th date for the christening of the new boat and another little gala celebration that the Harbor Department is going to be putting on. So put that in your calendars. And, you know, the primary purpose is, again, is to christen the new boat, the 64. And ironically enough, the 64 coincides with the 50th anniversary of Morro Bay. It's kind of ironic. So we'll have some fun things.
We planned it that way.
Very nice. So mark that down in your calendar, everyone. May 17th, we'll christen the new Harbor Patrol boat. That'll be fun.
10 to 12.
From 10 to noon. Any other board member announcements, presentations? Yes, Alan.
I believe that the blessing of the fleet was entered at the wrong date, and I'm not sure if that was in the minutes of this committee, but the blessing of the fleet is going to occur on April 27th.
Okay. I think Eric had that in his report, so I'm sure he'll cover that as well. Thank you, Alan. Dana? Microphone?
Yeah, I think that it was added to the yacht club's opening day is the way it's written out previously, and which is the 13th. So that's why they just kind of added it on there. So that there is a parade and everything. So I think that's where the confusion comes from. But so there's two events. There's opening day at the yacht club, which will have a parade, and then there's also blessing of the fleet, which is 2 weeks later on it.
So we'll fast forward to you, Eric, on this item. Not to steal some of your thunder, but I want to avoid confusion for the audience and the viewers at home. So do those dates ring true with you that Dana just mentioned?
Yes, that sounds correct.
All right. So the Yacht Club opening day is which day?
That would be Sunday, April 13th.
And the blessing of the fleet, not to be confused with the blessing of the feet, is on which day?
April 27th. Isn't that right, Alan?
April 27th. Okay, good deal. Any other announcements, presentations? Thank you. I think that's the longest time we've ever spent on that little section, so thanks for bearing with us. We will now move on to public comment period. Members of the audience wishing to address the board on city business matters other than scheduled items may do so at this time. So please step forward, let us know who you are, and anything that you'd like to share with us, and this is for items that aren't on the agenda, or if you don't have time to stick around for those items on the agenda, you can come up now. So public comment period is hereby open.
Pirate Steve in Morro Bay. Thank you for your support. Hey, I wanted to remind everyone there's the Kite Festival coming up April 27th and 28th of this month. And then we also have the Pirate Mermaid Parade coming up on the May 31st, Saturday, at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I brought a pirate's favorite treat for everybody, which is Chips Ahoy.
Chips Ahoy, very nice.
For snacks.
There's dinner.
Thank you.
Are we ready for a break?
Thank you, Steve. Anyone else for public comment? Arg. All right. Thank you, Steve. Public comment is hereby closed. We will move on to the consent calendar. Item A1, the approval of the minutes from the Harbor Advisory Board meeting held on March 6, 2014. Any changes or amendments to the minutes as presented? No changes? All right. Look for a motion to approve.
So moved.
Moved by Lynn to approve the minutes, seconded by Bill. All in any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? So that passes unanimously. Now move on to public hearings, reports, and appearances. Item B on our agenda, the Harbor Department status report. Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Recurring item has come up on a few months running here, North Key Pier Maintenance and Repair, major project, as you know. Associated Pacific has got most materials ordered. They're already starting to put material in the Dynegy parking lot, the Triangle lot at the Front Street parking lot area. Starting to stage. We're meeting with them, doing pre-construction meetings. The one fly in my ointment is I still have not received a permit from the Corps of Engineers, which comes out of their Ventura office. I'm trying to get through that. Hopefully that'll be issued on the 9th. That's what they're anticipating. So cross our fingers, knock on wood. Hopefully we get that permit and they'll start work pretty soon. They're going to begin at the base of the pier where the pier meets the pavement, do some bulkhead work, and then most of their work from then on out will be by their usual crane barge out on the pier and working section by section, moving out from the base of the pier out to the wings. So look for that coming fairly soon. Hopefully mid-April we'll get going in earnest. On lease news, on March 25th, the City Council again considered the Verge's Landing proposal for that vacant lease site south of the South T Pier. They deferred any action on it until they could get some more information on the boatyard and the possibility of that location being a haul out for the actual ways. We are anticipating bringing to the council at the either second meeting in April or the first meeting in May, that boatyard history, and try and get that project moving forward one way or another and get some of those questions answered. So that'll be good to keep that project moving if possible. The February 25th council meeting, council authorized the mayor and the harbor director. That'd be myself. I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. on our annual CMANC, which is the California Marine Affairs and Navigation Conference. Annual D.C. trip where we visit our legislators and Corps of Engineers headquarters, fisheries folks for us, fishing harbors, and express our legislative and budgetary concerns. Had a little different weather this year. Snowed on us a couple of the days. So we're trudging around in D.C. in our trench coats and top hats, which was kind of interesting. But made some good progress. We were able to meet with Lois Capps personally, which was kind of nice because generally the legislators are in the middle of lots of major things going on in committee work and they're not available. But Lois was able to meet with us, and we met with representatives from Boxers and Feinstein's office, Corps of Engineers, NOAA Fisheries. All in all, had pretty good meetings. Visited the Office of the Management of the Budget, OMB. That's a scary place, and how that whole thing works, and that bureaucracy. But otherwise, did pretty well. I think we're pretty reasonably assured for the next few years for our dredging funding, which is our primary concern for going there. And then the fishery stuff, some of the latest issues du jour we try to bring up in terms of, swordfish is one of the things going on right now, and then the groundfish fishery and ITQs and observers and all that stuff. So we try to bring some of those issues forward to NOAA and express our concerns. So all in all, pretty good trip. Snowy plover fencing is gone up. As you know, we have critical habitat for the not endangered, the threatened western snowy plover. We follow state parks protocol, as you know, and put up the symbolic fencing around our areas that have fence or that have potential plover habitat. For us, it's exclusively out on the sand spit, basically the northern 3/4 miles of the sand spit is city property. We don't have any viable snowy plover habitat from the rock to about the creek because there's too much human and other traffic. State Parks takes over from there. That's their property, and they do have habitat from there on down to the campground, so they put the same fencing up. So same as past years, just ask that the public, both themselves and their animals, respect the fencing and stay out of it and try and share the beach with the little birds as much as they can. Some otter studies, as you know, back in 2012, PG&E was working on a permit to have some high-energy seismic testing work done offshore for studies for the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. As part of that, they funded some work by California Department of Fish and Game/Fish and Wildlife to tag otters and put some sort of tracking and transmitting devices in them surgically in anticipation that they were assuming that seismic study project would get done. It wasn't. It was, as you know, got shut down by Coastal Commission. But Fish and Game, having gotten ahead of the curve in terms of the project needing to get the animals tagged and out there back in the water before the project started, they did it before the whole process was shut down. So they installed the transmitters. They were here during the week of March 10th trying to recapture the otters that they tagged and pull the units back out. I think they got a hold of two. Had a little bit of a hard time with weather and cooperations with the animals. The animals weren't too happy about being caught. It's interesting process the way they do. They come up from below with this kind of a netted basket, come up from below diving and try and come up when the otters are laying there on their backs or sunning or wrapped up in kelp and trap them from below and then get them on a boat and bag them and tag them and bring them back to the surgical trailer and run them through, kind of like a UFO coming down from the sky and abducting you and then returning you. It's kind of strange. So that all went well. They, like I said, I think they caught two animals and got the tags out of them. It'll be interesting to see what they find in terms of where they went and what the animals do. And then upcoming events, like we said, we had a couple of corrections. April's a busy month. It's Festivus is what we're calling April now because there's so many things going on. April 5th is the opening season day for this year's recreational salmon fishing. We do have a season this year. I think they've changed the limits a little bit. Gene? Is it the same? Okay. So they're open for a month before commercial salmon season opens, which is typically May 1. I don't know if they've Fish and Game has officially announced it yet, but that's typically when it is. So we'll be looking forward to that and hopefully have some fish. Recreational rockfish season also opens May 1. So that'll be when our launch ramp really starts lighting up from a more purely weekend time to throughout the week. So that'll be good to get that activity back. The Morro Bay National Estuary Program, State of the Bay. Typically in the years past, they've done that over a weekend or sometimes over a week. This year, they've spread their activities out over the entire month. They're having, on April 12th, a State of the Bay family event at Tidelands Park. They do various events at the Natural History Museum, at the NBNEP offices, and various other places across the county in celebration of their State of the Bay event. So you can go to www.mbnep.org if you're looking for more information. April 12th has the Morro Bay Emergency Vehicle Show starting at 9 a.m., going to 3 p.m. on Main Street and Morro Bay Boulevard. As in past years, we've been off and on in our participation, but we're on this year. We're going to be putting some equipment in that show. I believe they're one of the vehicles they're restoring or is restored is either a vehicle that was a Morro Bay police car back in the early 60s or a similar vehicle to kind of show what the equipment was like then and now, so that'll be fun. April 13th, as Dana said, is opening day of the Yacht Club. Look for those activities there. And then April 27th is the Blessing of the Fleet. April 19th, the Miracle Mile for Kids Fun Run from Morro Rock to Cayucas Pier. There are several runs that go from the rock to the pier. The city has two, and the Miracle Mile for Kids has one on April 19th. April 20th, that's Easter Sunday. The Easter Sunday services at the Rock is occurring again. Pretty well-organized event. Goes on all day there. So look for that out at the Rock on the 20th. And then the Kite Festival, April 26th to 27th. We'll see if we get wind this year. Had a couple of years that pretty much blew the place apart, and a couple of years that have been not a lot of wind, and a couple of years have been just right. So we'll see what this year brings. And then too late for publication. We are applying for another grant from the California Department of Boating and Waterways for their VTIP program, which is their vessel turn-in program. It's kind of a spin-off of their abandoned vessel grant program, where agencies such as ours are able to apply for grants for derelict vessel abatement and demolition. The VTIP program is a sister program that funds a good amount of money for agencies up and down the coast to take boats from folks that just don't really want to own their boats anymore and realize that, for a lot of boats, it's not like you can just go bring to the junkyard and drop it off and get rid of it. It's not so easy with boats. So VTIP program, call us, the Morro Bay Harbor Department. We're applying for another grant this year. We have grant funding this year for this current fiscal year, although we've pretty much got enough boats to take care of it, but we'll be applying next year. And we apply on the basis of the interest in folks coming to us, so we encourage folks if they've got old boats or derelict boats that they want to get rid of rather than just walk away from them or let them rot, in the water or somewhere else in some backwater, we'll help you get rid of them. Tsunami info, Alan, I've got to apologize. I was going to bring some tsunami info and what we do and what the protocols are. I'll bring that next week, although it would have been kind of handy to have because we've had a little bit of a possibility this week with that 8.2 quake down in Chile. Fortunately, it turned into nothing, at least on our part of the Pacific Ocean. And then finally, and I spoke to this earlier, the Morro Bay Fish and Community Sustainability Plan is set to go to the council on the 8th for consideration of its findings and acceptance of it, and hopefully some recommendation on some of its some implementation action on some of its recommendations. So we'll see what happens on the 8th. I think I'm done.
Very good. Any questions for our director with regard to his report? Ron?
Eric, did I read correctly or incorrectly that some long time ago, keeping a portion of the bay navigable is a federal mandate?
The harbor, as you know, was created federally back in World War II to create a Navy training base. And since then, every year since, it is a congressionally authorized project, which is typically what, in core speak, whether it's a lock or a dam or a harbor channel dredging or all the waterway things that Corps of Engineers does, it has to be a congressionally authorized project, which our dredging is. Are they obligated every year to come dredge? No. It's up to the President and Congress to appropriate the money to do it. Unlike our brethren to the south, Port San Luis, their breakwater and their dredging, although federally built, are not
currently congressionally authorized projects, and they are trying to fight to get them authorized, to get core funding to do them. So we're on the other side of that coin where we are authorized, and core is able to justify every year based on a number of things that checklists that they go through to determine, you know, who gets money and who doesn't, because obviously the federal pie is limited, and they can only pay for X amount of projects. We fortunately every year have been able to get enough boxes checked, so to speak, to get the Aquinnah to come back and do our most critical work on an annual basis, and then hopefully in the 5 to 7 year range we get the whole harbor dredging, which we got with American Reinvestment and Recovery Act era funding back in 2008-2009. We're starting to get into that window, and we're starting to talk to Corrigan about, hey, it's time to start thinking about the $7 to $8 million project. So but not absolutely mandated. The President and Congress could say, no, we're not giving more money anymore.
Any other questions or comments? April is a busy month. I was founded in the same year as our city, so April 9th will be my big celebration. So there we go, the half-century mark. Thank you, Eric, for that report. We'll now move on to item B2, which is a presentation by the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Office on Mexican smuggling pongas along the Central California coast. So we'll invite that representative at this time up to the lectern, and we certainly thank him for being here.
Good evening. My name is Jim Taylor. I'm a commander with the Sheriff's Office. I'm in charge of our headquarters division, and one of the tasks that I'm charged with is tracking and monitoring the drug smuggling activity that is going on currently along our coast. I'm sure you're all familiar and you've seen the news stories about the recent events that have occurred. We were going to do a briefing with you and provide some information via PowerPoint on kind of the whole story that has been occurring. It's nothing new to hear about Mexican national drug trafficking organizations smuggling drugs. It's nothing new to even hear that they smuggle by boat. But what is new is that they're coming this far north, and in fact they're going even further north. It's become increasingly apparent that they've modified their tactics. What they're doing now in some cases is going as far out to sea as 250 miles, utilizing secondary vehicles from ports to our south for refueling, and proceeding further north, and in some cases we've recovered navigation equipment that's shown they've made it as far north as Bodega Bay. It is a regularity now that they are making smuggling routes and arriving from Ventura, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo counties, well into Monterey and Santa Cruz counties. This is occurring weekly along the Central California coast. In part, they are coming here because the strategy that U.S. Customs and Border Protection and the U.S. Coast Guard have employed on the southern waters is working. They are stopping them down there, which is what's forcing them to go further out to sea and further north to basically try and get around the resources. Sheriff Parkinson and Under Sheriff Olivas have worked to secure grant funding from the U.S. government through Operation Stone Garden. They have secured a total of $350,000 for San Luis Obispo County to help offset the costs and also to put out extra patrols to try and deter or stop these people when they come to our coastline. Some of the money is used for equipment that's used for the investigations, and some of the money is used to actually pay the overtime costs that are incurred when we have an event, or the overtime costs that are incurred to put out extra patrols, especially along the North Coast area. We're working in partnership with the state parks, which are also supplementing their patrols. We're also working with the California National Guard, which have sent teams of soldiers to basically work as observation personnel to watch coastline. They're using high-tech equipment that they have available to them that allows them to see long distances, look for heat signatures at sea, things of that nature. So we're doing everything that we can to try and address the issue, but they're still coming. And when you see some of the information, you'll see they've been coming for a while, and it's been more of a problem than we had anticipated. The Ponga boat, it's developed by Yamaha. The name is derived from the word knife. They have a high bow, narrow waterline beams. They've got a flotation bulge along the gunwale. We say 19 to 28 feet in length, but we've had them as long as 45 feet in length. In fact, we have one currently that's out at the sheriff's office on Kansas Avenue that we had to drain 400 gallons of fuel from an internal tank. It's about 45 feet long. So they're really not limited by the size. It's as big as they want to make the boat. The boats are typically sailed out of Ensenada or the port south. The boats are generally operated by middlemen who are contracted by the drug trafficking organizations, and when these middlemen are not smuggling drugs or aliens or other things in the United States, they're available for charter fishing from tourists, and often one boat is doing double duty. The top speed is 35 miles an hour, or 35 knots, rather. This is dependent upon the engines. We currently have a number of engines that were seized as found property for boats that were found abandoned. These engines are going to be going to auction down in Long Beach when the 90-day period is over. These engines are new Yamaha 350 horsepower outboard engines, and some of the boats have had as many as four engines mounted to them. So they're building these boats for speed and for long-range travel, and they're doing a pretty good job of it. We've had 12 known landings since the first, which occurred on May 24th. So 12 known landings, the last one being in February this month. The closest landing sites have been near Piedras Blancas. They tend to try to go to the north coast because they know that it's sparsely populated, particularly in the winter months. They know there's not a lot of folks up there, especially on the weekdays. On May 24th, which was the first, May 24th of 2012, that was the first experience we had. We found a Ponga boat that was abandoned in our county. There were 20 bales of marijuana that the suspects had left behind. They simply didn't have enough time to move it off the beach up to the delivery vehicles. And they had 55-gallon drums of fuel that were dispersed along the beach, which had to be cleaned up. With the assistance of the Highway Patrol, we were able to sling it off the beach with a helicopter so we didn't disturb the habitat trying to drive down there to get it all out. The next event was September 6th of 2012. That event, there was 3,000 pounds of marijuana seized. We arrested 20 people who were responsible. We seized a motorhome, trucks, and sedans. What their MO has been is that they are using large Class A motorhomes and large U-Haul type delivery vehicles. The motorhomes will travel often up Highway 101 and then across 46 from Paso Robles. The motorhomes will be empty except for one or two individuals. There will be panel vans that will be carrying up to 10 or 12 individuals in each one. That's the offload crew. There is usually a sedan, and the sedan is occupied by a member of the actual drug trafficking organization. He's the handler or the coordinator that's there to make sure that the load gets delivered, make sure it gets off the beach into the motorhome, and then the motorhome returns to Southern California, and the drugs are dispersed from there. We have intercepted a number of these cases, a number of these groups, and in each case we've gained intelligence from some of the electronic equipment that we've collected from the drug trafficking organization. On October 19th, we had another Ponga boat that arrived off of Santa Cruz. It was an abandoned Ponga. There was discarded clothing, 6 gasoline containers. Evidence suggests that may have been an alien smuggling ring. We are seeing some evidence that the traffickers are not just carrying the drugs, but aliens as well. Our concern, of course, is that we don't know how many boats are lost at sea, and what happens to those people is of concern to us. Even though they shouldn't be here, you still are concerned about their welfare. November 23rd, or correction, 22nd, we had another incident. The two gentlemen that are on the board were arrested. they were part of the offload crew that was caught. The rest of the group managed to get away, and the boat returned to the south. On May 29th, we had a 35-foot Ponga boat that landed in Montana de Oro. There were 14 suspects arrested, 1,900 pounds of marijuana seized. This case actually occurred because our narcotics detectives were out on surveillance looking for Ponga boats. One of the things that they had been doing was to check the local motels and looking for vehicles that are coming from certain communities that we know are tied to these Mexican drug trafficking organizations. They found these vehicles. They surveilled these vehicles. They saw activity that is consistent with the kind of behavior we believe they were engaged in. They ended up following them to Montana de Oro and caught them while they were actually offloading the boat that had come in. They didn't know the boat was coming in, but they knew they had the offload crew, so they followed them, and they were able to get these people into custody. On September 10th, 2013, we had an abandoned 30-foot Ponga, twin engines. There was a single 30-pound bale of marijuana. Again, it appeared in that instance they simply ditched the boat. It may have had mechanical problems, or it's quite possible that they didn't intend on returning in it anyway. On October 5th, we had an abandoned 35-foot Ponga. This was at Estero Bluffs. They rammed the state park gate, drove down out of sight, used a signal fire to signal the boat. The boat came in, they offloaded, and then they left the area. And we recovered the boat in the morning after some day hikers had discovered it. On October 16th, our detectives were out on surveillance, and we had an agent who was assigned to our office from Homeland Security Investigations, and he was at a fixed post watching traffic at Highway 101 and 46 West when he saw this motorhome that you see in the photograph with a single occupant turn off of the highway at about 2 o'clock in the morning and proceed out 46. They grabbed the plate and they ran it. It came back to the city of Paramount in Southern California, which is one of the cities we look for. So the detectives picked the vehicle up and just started following it a long distance. It proceeded north through Cambria on Highway 1, where it was joined by two panel vans and a sedan. They allowed them to go to the north coast. They were gone on the north coast area, north of San Simeon, for about a half an hour, and then they returned. They followed the vehicles back across Highway 46. They initiated traffic stops on them, and they were able to arrest all of the suspects, stop the motorhome, and seize 144 bales of marijuana. In this particular case, what we learned was that these individuals that are the offload crews are just hirelings. They're hired. They're paid $500, $700, $1,000. They're not associated with a drug trafficking organization. They're just up here trying to make a dollar, and they're letting themselves out for this kind of work. On December 23rd, we found another abandoned boat. This was spotted by a highway patrol helicopter that's also engaged in patrols along the coastline. There were 204 bales of marijuana found. We later arrested one suspect who was from the boat and basically got left behind. Investigation determined that boat came in. It had been rough seas earlier, and they'd been unable to land. When they finally got in, they simply ran out of darkness, and rather than risk being caught unloading in daylight, they fled. January 14th, another 45-foot Super Ponga. This is the boat I told you about we currently have at the sheriff's office. Had 4,400 pounds of marijuana. There were 120 gallons of fuel recovered in tanks, plus the fuel that's in the tank that's mounted inside the boat. And then on 23rd of February, we had another 32-foot Ponga that was abandoned. This was across from San Simeon Campground. And the number of life jacks and the jackets and the number of empty food containers suggest that was an alien smuggling vessel. Our concern about this type of activity, besides the drug trafficking itself, is the risk that it poses to the public. Imagine being out on a hike. You're going to go out and go bird watching, and you stumble across one of these crews with 20 people. We don't know what they're capable of doing or to what level they would go to protect the product that they are smuggling into the country. So there is a risk to the public in that regard. There's also the ecological risk because of the potential damage from fuel that's being left on the beaches by these people and boats that are being abandoned and can cause navigation problems as well. And I'm free for any questions that you might have about this.
Thank you, Commander. So we will open it up for questions at this point in time. We'll start over on my left side with Alan.
Have there been cases where they've taken over boats at sea and transferred the cargo and disposed of the occupants?
Well, we have not had any information to suggest that that has occurred in the West Coast. That is something that has happened in the past in the Gulf of Mexico. It is something that U.S. Customs and Border Protection and the Coast Guard is aware of and concerned about, but we have no evidence that that has occurred on the West Coast of the United States.
Thank you.
Lynn?
You mentioned the hirelings. Are they generally local people who also might be working farms or something else, or are they coming up from...
They're coming up from the Los Angeles area.
From I mean,
the,
L.A.,
the entire
not from
crew
Mexico.
Basically leaves L.A. at different times, and they meet up near the area where the offload's going to occur. The offload is done. These folks are driven back down to Los Angeles. They're paid their money, and they go on their way. Then the drugs go to wherever they're being delivered, and from there they're distributed. To this point, all we have dealt with as far as narcotics has been the marijuana. What is concerning is that you could carry anything in these boats. Coast Guard intercepted a boat off the Ventura coast, and there was a large backpack filled with methamphetamine, which was worth probably $3.5 million. What we suspect from intelligence that we've gathered in other cases is that what occurs is there's probably somebody in the boat that's wearing that backpack who is a cartel employee, and as soon as he's off the boat, he's in a separate vehicle and gone, because that's worth far more to them than the marijuana is. Marijuana is almost kind of a secondary product, we're thinking. The other thing that is concerning to us is if they can carry 4,500 pounds of marijuana or 15 or 20 aliens, what else could they carry? Could they carry people who are not supposed to be in the United States because they're on some type of terrorist watch list? Could they be bringing in other substances? Is it possible to transport, for example, a dirty bomb or something? We don't want to unnecessarily frighten people, but if they can bring 4,500 pounds of marijuana this far north or even further north, what can't they bring into the United States? So we're, again, making every effort we can to try and combat it. We've been fortunate in getting funding from the U.S. government to help offset the cost so the county doesn't bear the burden alone. But it's a problem everybody needs to be aware of and everybody needs to keep an eye out for.
And are the Pongas a totally open boat?
Yes. The ones we have encountered are totally open. Well, let me back up. They're totally open. Some of them, the front bow is covered. But they're essentially an open boat. And the ones we've been encountering recently, the really long ones, the 35 and 45-foot boats, they're being built, when you look at them, they're being built to transport product, cargo, something of that nature. When we were dealing with the shorter boats, it was clear they were fishing vessels and they were just piling people into them. But the one we have out at the sheriff's office, when we got into it and inspected it, when you jumped down into it, it was this high. You were looking up over the side of the boat. So it was made to carry a lot of product and to keep it safe and secure for the journey.
Thank you.
Commander, in the example that you gave with the motorhome on the recovery of assets, you didn't have the boat listed there. So are we to assume that the boat left?
We did recover that boat. It was found. That one was also found south of Piedras Blancas on the surf, and the crew had fled. And I don't know. I don't think we've ever determined if it was mechanical problem or if they got spooked. We had an incident in August, I think it was August 21st of last year, where one of our patrols that's being paid for by this federal grant money found several vehicles and approximately 12 occupants who spoke only Spanish standing on the side of the road south of Piedras Blancas at 2 o'clock in the morning. And while the deputies who spoke Spanish were interviewing them to find out what they were doing there, a Ponga boat pulled in right beneath them. saw the patrol car lights and turned around and went back out to sea. We don't know where that boat ever went.
So that was where I was leading with my question. Do the boats normally, after they make a drop-off, do you know if they go back?
Normally they want to go back. Normally they want to go back because they've got a lot of money invested in those engines, if nothing else.
Right.
I mean, some of this equipment, it's not, they're not using junky engines. I wish I had some of these engines, frankly. You know,
is there any indication of how they pick their landing locations?
We have seen landing locations in this county from below Ragged Point to Montana de Oro. We haven't encountered any at Oceano Dunes, but to me that would be a perfect location to land because you can drive right to the water's edge. And it may simply be that we haven't caught them because it is such a quick, you know, you land the boat, you load the product, and you're gone. They have landed in Guadalupe, at Guadalupe State Beach. Santa Barbara has encountered them there. We know they've landed along beaches near surf. I think that they simply look for an area that is either sparsely populated or a certain time of the year. There tends to not be a lot of people around, certain days and times. They tend to look for a high tide period to make it a little easier to get into some of the areas to our north that are rocky. But literally, it could be anywhere. I wouldn't be stunned if you said we had one land, you know, on Morrow Bay. We had one land out here by the rock, and they carried the stuff up and drove away from the parking lot. It wouldn't surprise me.
My last question for you, and we'll continue moving down the line, is for members of the public, what's the best way for us to communicate with law enforcement agencies? Because I noticed that there was a marine radio on one of the vessels. So
right.
Is it advisable that if we're out on the water as mariners, we probably shouldn't use the marine radio and maybe use our cell phone if we have service?
I would say if you were within cell phone distance, you could use your cell phones. But the fact of the matter is, alert us by any method. And if you're on the water, alert the Coast Guard so that they can start a response. They'll notify us. Our next course of action would be to call the Highway Patrol to get the helicopter or one of their fixed wing in the air to try and track it.
So if we're on the water, then an immediate call on Channel 16 to the Coast Guard is appropriate?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I'll continue moving down the line, Bill. Dana? And
I'll come back. I was wondering, you're using federal funds, but what is the U.S. Coast Guard's involvement in this county?
In this county, what they've been doing is conducting patrols off the coast. They've been assisting us with the recoveries of the beached vessels, getting them back into the water and towed down to Morrow Bay and then getting them out of the water for us. They're in kind of a difficult position because they're equipped more for sea rescue, really, than pursuit and enforcement. They're aware, Coast Guard Command is aware of the problem, and they're trying to reallocate resources towards this area. And I know U.S. Customs and Border Protection is looking at putting fast boats further north. I don't know if they'll come as far north as Morrow Bay, but they may come as far north as Port San Luis to try and interdict them as they're basically coming in. These boats are going out 200 miles, and once they get past the Channel Islands, it's just simple geometry as to where exactly they're going to go. It's a straight line, you know, of varying degrees, whichever beach they've decided to go towards.
Yeah, that was my question. It's just concerned about, like you said, if they can load that much product mm-hmm. in a boat, you know, what else could they carry?
Right
past a nuclear power plant.
And that
seems like the Coast Guard needs to be involved more.
Well, I wouldn't say that they're not involved. It's just the types of missions and the kind of equipment that they have. Traditionally, they've been dealing with, you know, vessels in distress, and so they're playing catch-up with their own organization to get the equipment that they need. One of the measures that we're taking is we've obtained federal money to purchase a safe boat, a 27-foot safe boat, that'll be operated by the sheriff's office. That'll have twin 300-horsepower engines. We've got some deputies who are former Coast Guard personnel that are trained, and they'll also be going to boating school to operate it, so that'll give us additional flexibility both for Diablo and to deal with this threat. So, you know, I don't want anybody to think, well, there's nobody on the water and we're totally unprotected. We are doing everything we can as quickly as we can to meet the threat on the water. It's just, you know, sort of jumped up at us.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dana. Ron?
Commander, given that these boats in a particular sea state are going to be moving faster than most of the traffic is going to be moving, we've had some contact with the interdiction people, my firm down in Florida, and that's oftentimes how they're how they're spotted is by virtue of the speed. What level of illegal activity would, if you have an opinion, would justify the application of airborne assets that have the ready ability to identify fast movers?
They are using, both Coast Guard and Customs and Border Protection are using aircraft. What we are seeing is a reallocation of resources from the border. Not to talk about national politics, but events that were going on in Congress a while back where, one party was holding the president's feet to the fire about border security prompted a lot of resources to be sent to the border. The border got locked down, which is what is now causing more and more of this marine smuggling because the border was locked down. Now we are seeing the government responding to this threat by reallocating resources, but they don't want to send everything at one time. They are flying aircraft periodically out of Paso Robles and then flying the coastline north up to the Bay Area. They routinely fly aircraft out of Port Hueneme. They fly out of Point Magoo, rather. They fly aircraft out of San Diego. And, of course, the Coast Guard in Long Beach operates helicopters out of the Long Beach port. So they're dedicating the assets, the air assets. But, these guys travel at night. During the daytime, often they throw a mottled colored tarp over the top, and they just ride the swells. At night, they take off. They're throwing wet towels over the engines to try and reduce the heat signature. They're not making it easy. They're good at what they do. They wouldn't be in business if they weren't. So, it's. I wish there was a panacea where we'll put aircraft up and we've got them, but it's going to be multifaceted how we respond and catch them, or at least deter them to go into some other strategy.
Thank you, Ron. Gene.
Yes. On your sheriff's deputies who are patrolling at night, do you think that you could take some of your daytime patrol personnel and allocate them towards the night to help booster that response?
Well, the problem is, unfortunately, we have got such a large area to cover countywide. And I know it sounds like an old song for government employees to say we don't have enough resources, but I've worked for the sheriff's office for 28 years, and we're still staffing the same beat areas with the same number of deputies and the same number of patrol cars we did in 1986. So it would probably be better to take the federal government's money and simply pay overtime to put more people out than to strip our day shift patrol, and then people are vandalizing and burglarizing things, and we have nobody to respond.
The reason I ask is my son is a sheriff and patrolling at night.
Oh, so. You want him to work nights, or would you? I'll fix that for you if you want him to.
No. He's happy. The other question is the berthing of the new sheriff's boat. Mm-hmm. Are you anticipating that in Morro Bay?
I don't know if they've made a decision where it's going to be berthed or if it's just going to be launched when there's a threat or when they decide to do patrols. I don't think the sheriff's made that decision yet.
Any other questions? Any from staff? Nope. All right. Commander Taylor, thank you so much for coming and giving your presentation tonight. We appreciate your time, and we appreciate all that the Sheriff's Department is doing to aid in this problem that we have. Thank you. That concludes item B2, and we will now move on. A1, the approval of the minutes? We did that already.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were speedy. We sped through that one. So we'll move on. Thank you, though, for bringing that up. We move on to item C, unfinished business. Item C1, which is a review of the liveaboard ordinance regarding marine surveyor certification and standardization of liveaboard permit inspection. I notice that there are some folks here that I do recognize as liveaboards. So I'll explain to you how we'll go through this process. Eric will give his report. We will ask any questions at that time, and then we'll open up for a question for a public comment. And the idea there is that you have the opportunity to give public comment after hearing the full report and any questions that we have. So that's how we will do it. So we'll move on to Eric. Thank you.
Thank you again. So this item is a carryover from our standard annual liveaboard report that we give generally once a year. We gave it last in November of 2013, where we review the number of permits and our enforcement activity and, you know, just kind of all things liveaboard and what's been going on and how the program's working. Some questions that came out of or concerns that came out of that report from the board back in November were surveyor accreditation and what the liveaboard ordinance itself says that the inspections can be done by a harbor patrol officer or a marine surveyor, quote-unquote, acceptable to the city, which with no definition of acceptable, the Harbor Advisory Board's concern was, you know, what does acceptable mean? So that's one of the items we're bringing back. Standards of the inspection were concerned over whether our inspections are being equally applied between public and private. It used to be in the past that all of our, pretty much all of our inspections were done by the Harbor Patrol. Back in, I'm going to be guessing, but when we had a boatyard committee put together from the Harbor Advisory Board back in, I'm going to say 2004, 2005, 2006, somewhere through there, to try and clean up the liveaboard ordinance. It had been about 10 years since it was implemented. Might have been about 2002. And kind of look back and see if it was working, if it wasn't working in certain areas, what we could streamline. We took about, I don't know, Lynn, were you on the committee? And we met for maybe, yeah, Bill, you were. We met for maybe 8 months to a year, off and on. Came up with some changes to the liveaboard ordinance, one of which being breaking up the liveaboard fee into two components, one component being sort of an administrative fee for the cost of department staff dealing with the permit and the paperwork end of it, and another component being the Harbor Patrol staff actually going and doing the actual inspection. At that point, local marine surveyor in town started doing many of the inspections because I think before it was one permit fee and you had to pay it whether we did the inspection or whether a marine surveyor did the inspection. When we broke it up, some of our liveaboards took advantage of being able to do it a little bit cheaper, because I don't know the two broken down fees off the top of my head. I think it might be on the form itself, but the local surveyor was able to do it for at low or no cost, so I think a lot of people opted for that just simply to save money. So the question of are we doing all our inspections the same, and is there a standard of an inspection that we need to look at? And then consistency of the inspection between public and private, and I think that just feeds right into the standard. Are we all doing it the same way? You wanted it back and bring it back to kind of review those things a little bit deeper and discuss it and see if there's any other changes we wanted to try and make to it, or suggestions to, you know, whether we want to try and put together that liveaboard committee again or try and knock something out here. I guess it's all on the table and see if it's time to review the liveaboard ordinance. We do have some other things that we'd like, you know, eventually to address in the liveaboard ordinance that we've struggled with over the years. So related, but not the items here that we're looking at tonight. So I guess we'll just open it up to the board and the public discussion and see where we want to go with it.
Thank you, Eric. So at this time, board members, if you have any questions for Eric, I'd like you to refrain from actual discussion at this point until we do hear from members of the public. So if there are any questions for Eric regarding the report that he just gave on this item. Great. Okay, so we want to hear from our public. So we will open up public comment period at this time. So, members of the public, you are welcome to come up and address the board on this issue. Just please state your name and city of residence, and it would be helpful if you told us if you're a liveaboard or not, and share any opinions that you have on this matter. So please come forward now. Nobody. Okay. Well, thank you for being here. Public comment period is closed. And again, I thank you for being here, for observing the process. So let's open up to discussion on this point. As Eric mentioned, we're wide open at this point. We have several options in front of us. We can make a few specific recommendations tonight to Eric with regard to the city ordinances that he would take forward to the council. We can reconvene an ad hoc committee on the liveaboard issue. We can ask some questions, further questions about the certification process. So, concerns, questions, discussion at this point. Gene.
Yeah, the nomenclature that I'm reading on Alan's screen here, where did that come from? Is that something we're just, things like boat to, shall be safe to go to open sea or something like that? Where did those qualifications come from, those standards?
Eric?
They live in two places in all of our rules and regulations and in the liveaboard ordinance. Generally speaking, and let me dig out my materials. This, and I'm going to talk slowly while I find this. The Harbor Department rules and regulations have a section on operability and seaworthiness that basically say, how am I doing? Great, I don't have it in front of me. All right, I'm looking at the wrong thing here. Well, I'll start with the liveaboard ordinance. The liveaboard ordinance stipulates, and I'm going to go read, it's in your staff report. It may be a little buried, so it's sometimes hard to find, but the liveaboard ordinance says that a liveaboard vessel must be in compliance with all sections, meaning the liveaboard ordinance and Morro Bay rules and regulations. Vessels to be used for liveaboard purposes must be in good material condition, not likely to sink or become a menace to navigation, and to be of a design suitable for operation on the waters of the Pacific Ocean. All vessels must be currently registered or documented. That's, and then they go into marine sanitation device requirements and a few other things, but that's the core sort of definition, the liveaboard ordinance. I'm going to get on my fancy electronic device here and see if I can pull up what it says about operability and seaworthiness in the rules and regulations. Until I find that, any other questions on that?
Well, I guess my question is, I don't have it in front of me, but I read boat needs to be able to go to sea or something like that. But we used to use the word seaworthy, and apparently we still are. So what I was reading was probably just a generic statement.
Yeah, we've got in the ordinance when you do the inspection that the vessel has to travel to, we used to do it at our harbor office docks, but we started doing it at Tidelands Dock. The vessel must make way to a place of inspection under its own power without being a threat to navigation or danger to sink or cause injury. So in our liveaboard ordinance, or in our rules and regulations, which I'll dig up here and find that, we give a little more definition of operability and seaworthiness. And I think in the operability part, it says that the vessel can make way to the harbor entrance. And then from a seaworthiness standpoint, it defines some general conditions of rot and falling apartness.
So, and just as a matter of reference, too, in the municipal code, the definition there of is in section 15.40.040, item number A1, just as for reference in the muni code. And then it sounds like it's amplified or further defined by Harbor Department policy.
Paragraph A says under its own power.
Correct.
So.
Always under its own power.
Always under its own power, which.
So under our rules and regulations. So there's the municipal code that has all the code and regulation, and then inside the municipal code there's a section in there that refers to from time to time the city council shall set rules and regulations by ordinance or by resolution, which they do, and then what's attached to that is our Harbor Department rules and regulations, the customized 8 or 10 sheets. And then under that, operable, and here's the definition, operable means capable of maneuvering under a vessel's own power to the harbor entrance or to an inspection site designated by the harbor director and back to its berthing location. Seaworthy shall mean the vessel's hull, keel, decking, cabin, and mast are structurally sound and generally free from structural rusting, delamination, or dry rot. Operable and seaworthy was something that as a member of the Harbor Masters Association, California Harbor Masters Association, we struggled with for years because there was no definition in Harbors and Navco to what seaworthiness means, because it can mean a lot of different things depending on the operator and the boat and the conditions, and there's no one size fit all. At some point, it comes down to somewhat of a judgment call. What is seaworthy under a general, under a given condition? We put this in. It wasn't, I'm trying to remember when we added this in, because our first round of this rules and regulations didn't have it in. I think we put it in after a series of issues with some boats at our piers that we were dealing with that were sinking on us, and we needed something to hang our hat on in terms of enforcement that we could, some sort of code, because it really wasn't in our code, and that's where we came up with this.
Do you know, Eric, about any discussions at the Harbor Department or prior when we had a full-time city attorney, discussions about the issue of liability with regard to that word, to seaworthy? Because I've spoken with a few professionals in the industry, and that seems to be a very touchy word. And I suppose the inference is that if a body or a person, or in this case the city, claims that a vessel is seaworthy, and it turns out that something happened to that vessel, you know, it's essentially could be viewed that it was certified by the Harbor Department that it was seaworthy and may have a farther reaching effects than intended.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a concern or always a potential issue. I mean, in anything we deal with where we look at something, you know, we stamp something, our mooring inspections we do, you know, there's always that possibility. I think in terms of the liveaboard ordinance and application of operable and seaworthy, I would presume it would be strictly applied seaworthy in terms of seaworthy to remain in compliance with the liveaboard ordinance, not generally seaworthy to operate on all oceans at all times. But that's a great question, and no, we have not had the discussion with the city attorney, past or present.
Alan?
Somewhere in that mass of material, at the end of the agenda, I read that a boat had to be capable of operating on the Pacific Ocean, which implied, and then as far as being able to get to the inspection site and back, it said that requirement was just to meet the requirements of the inspection. But it would seem you'd need a marine surveyor to designate, you know, to certify a boat seaworthy. I mean,
so Alan, that's in the municipal code in 1540.040, item one, and it says to be of a design suitable for operation on the waters of the Pacific Ocean. So I can tell that the wording in the municipal code is chosen pretty carefully. So it's not saying necessarily that it is fully operable on the Pacific, but it does say that to be of a design suitable for operation on the waters of the Pacific.
Not necessarily you have to.
Right. What they're trying to do it is to keep people from building houses on barges and having them roll, you know, that would roll over if they went outside the harbor entrance.
Right. And those are specifically listed under item B above, 15.40.030. Item B, general restrictions for issuance. And there are some specifics listed, houseboats, barges, floating homes, or other such vessels or floating structures not specifically designed for or not safely capable of navigating ocean waters under their own power. So those are actually specifically called out.
Yeah, that was added. I mean, that was put in specifically because we didn't want to see houseboats and barges. You know, we had a couple way back when, and the liveaboard ordinance was crafted specifically to exclude those. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, it's a liability. I mean, it's a huge, not a huge, but it's, you know, it becomes a judgment call of what operable and seaworthy may be, and you know, one person's expertise versus another, and where the liability is. It's a great question. It is.
Gene?
Yeah. In the past year or so, have we had any major discrepancies between city or marine surveyor looking at it and the city looking at it, as opposed to seaworthiness of a boat? And then I'd also ask Ron to give us his professional opinion of seaworthiness.
I'd love to hear Ron's part first.
Okay. All right, we'll go to Ron, and then we'll go back to the first part of his question, please, Eric, and then we'll go over to Bill.
Thank you.
I'll address your question, Gene, but let me take the opportunity of doing so to say, having read what I think is all of the documentation that relates to liveaboards, I find it to be contradictory in some significant ways, and not the least of which is that the page 2 of the city's liveaboard inspection thing says that the inspector does not certify that the vessel is safe or seaworthy, even though apparently the guidelines require it to be. So, and the ordinance itself, I think, is fraught with liability, with unnecessary liability. And I think that there might be other ways to address the city's desires. I don't want to use the word concerns, but the city's desires relative to liveaboards, to regulating liveaboards. I think there's other ways to approach it. Irrespective of my personal opinion as to what constitutes seaworthiness, I can tell you that over 45 years of being a professional, I've been disabused of using that phrase in any way, shape, or form on a professional basis. I won't use that phrase on a professional basis. I don't allow any of my surveyors to use that word on a professional basis for the reasons that essentially that Eric pointed out, which is it is subjective at best. In maritime law, there is some definition, but it is applied on a circumstantial basis. So I think it's appropriate on the basis of what I perceive to be, and I could be wrong, of some contradictions in the present rules, regulations, guidelines, whatever you want to call them, relative to the liveaboards, and the need to address some things very clearly. For instance, let's take an example. There's nothing in the ordinances or in the guidelines that addresses essential safety equipment, which is covered under federal law, CFR 46. Also, as far as marine sanitation devices are concerned, there are some guidelines. There's very clearly promulgated guidelines by the American Boat and Yacht Council, which are voluntary standards. They do not have the force of law, but they are accepted and recognized both by the courts and by the United States Coast Guard. So I think it would be advisable for somebody to take another look at all this, a fresh look at this, and revisit the issue and maybe sort out some of the confusion.
Thank you, Ron. And would you please restate the first part of your question to Eric?
My question was, during the last year or so, in the city looking at boats with their Harbor Department inspection, and has there been any major discrepancies in whether maybe a marine surveyor may say? A marine surveyor may say, this boat is no good, and you may say, no, I think it's a good boat. Has there been any major discrepancies?
There has been one vessel, one liveaboard vessel is inspected that I'll just talk about it generically, that, yeah, there was a difference of opinion between my staff and myself and the private marine survey that was done on it. One that I can recall. It's a fairly new advent with private folks looking at them, I'm going to say, in the last 3 or 4 years, maybe a little longer. Time flies.
All right. Thank you. Bill.
Well, you know, bringing up the marine surveyors, I mean, that was one of the things that Becca, I think, was questioning. And in this ordinance here, it states that the city will allow qualified marine surveyors that meets the city's qualifications. So of the marine surveyors that are supposedly doing the inspections right now, do you have a list of qualified surveyors that the boat owners can go to?
No, we've never kept a list. We've never attempted to come up with some sort of criteria or a checklist that they have to comply with, and it's not really defined. It just says acceptable to the city, so they didn't create anything in the ordinance to go by. So, you know, one of the things that Becca was concerned about is that there is no checklist. So whether or not you, the city, or a Marine surveyor does it, I mean, at least I haven't seen in here, that would be transparent to both parties. I mean, you know, that would be applicable to both parties. I mean, do they have a separate checklist or?
Well, in terms of the inspection itself, yes. They're all the inspections are being done with the same, you know, 8 or 10 items that have to be checked off, and they're in your staff report. The person that's applying for the permit and getting the permit has to be the boat owner. That's to prevent rental-type uses on the bay. The boat's got to be good, you know, good material condition, suitable for operation on the Pacific Ocean. That's that whole operable and seaworthiness thing. Currently registered or documented, have adequate vessel sanitation facilities aboard, working VHF radio or cell phone, make way safely to the inspection site, and have a safe and legal berthing in Morro Bay besides the T-piers and the anchorage area. So, yeah, in terms of the inspection itself, those 7 items are on the inspection form or in the code that we all look at.
So here's where it can get sticky, is that you said there was one instance that you can recall where a Marine surveyor gave an okay signed off on a vessel, but the Harbor Department had a different opinion. So what happens in that case? Is there anything in policy or writing that would indicate what would happen, or is there, do both parties have to concur? So in other words, is there anything in writing, I guess, that addresses that situation?
No, there's not. Okay. And, you know, fortunately, it's not happening, you know, every third one to where it's a big issue. It's been one, but no, there's not. There is no process that we've identified or tried to identify that it's in the ordinance that really spells out what you do, other than just, you know, either flat out rejection, no, we're not going to take it, or.
Because that, to me, I mean, right there, there's a vague area that I think needs to be addressed in some form and shape, because it's happened once. Chances are it's going to happen again sometime in the future, and we should have some type. I would think that the Harbor Department should have some type of procedure to address it. Yes, Lynn.
Would not the phrase acceptable to the city actually make it the city that makes the determination if there is a discrepancy? If it's not acceptable to the city, then whatever the Marine surveyor says, who is not appointed by the city, is secondary. If you disagree, the city has to be the one to...
Yeah, I mean, strictly speaking, the ordinance speaks to, and I'm going to look at the section, I think it speaks to the surveyor being acceptable.
Right.
Not the inspection per se, individual inspection they did per se. If you really want to, you know, look at the exact words, it says the surveyor, not the individual inspection. So it would be more like Bill is referring to, do we have an approved list or not?
Well, you know, the thing is, and I think, Ron, is there is some vagueness in this whole, ordinance, but the reality is, how many liveaboard permits do we really have? Do we have, was it up to 30 now, or is it really, I think the last figure was like 22. So we're talking about 22 incidences. I mean,
yeah, we're in the mid-20s. I mean, it's gone up and down, up and down, yeah. And we've gotten a good majority of them.
Right.
You know, under Becca's leadership and running the program, she's done a heck of a lot better than I was ever able to do. We've got a good amount of compliance, so we're in the mid-20s.
Yes, Ron.
Eric, 2 questions. If you're in a position to answer them, do you think that the city has, in whatever party or however it's, whoever we're talking about when I say the city, has the city of Morro Bay made clear what is important to it relative to liveaboards?
Made clear in
having
what sense?
Having liveaboards in Morro Bay, has the city ever made clear what it's most interested in?
I would think that most of that, not to, I don't want to jump in on you, but I would think most of that would be represented in the ordinance.
Yeah, in the ordinance and the inspection criteria and the definitions of what a liveaboard is and what one can't be and how you do the permit inspection and how it can be revoked. Yeah, so, yeah, strictly speaking, I mean, it is defined in there, yes.
Good. I mean, and I thought that would be the case. So that's the foundation for any ongoing consideration is the ordinances. Would you also consider the harbor department's, I think, did you use the word regulations? I don't want to put words in your mouth. What?
Our harbor department rules and regulations.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what's adopted by council. By reference in the municipal code, it's kind of our catch-all of all the other stuff that's not in the Muni code.
So any current consideration of the liveaboard ordinance should by definition also include a consideration of the current rules and regulations?
Yes. I mean, any liveaboard and any boater in the bay is supposed to comply with all the rules and regulations, and obviously we're bound to, you know, go by those rules and regulations and enforcement and managing the facilities.
Okay, sure. Okay, so in my second question, how many extant permits are there at this time?
Back in November, we were just speaking to that. We're in the mid-20s. I want to say 23, 24. They go in two-year cycles. They used to be expiring randomly. We put them all on fiscal year cycles so that we could kind of deal with them all at once one time a year. But we've had as high, you know, when the liveaboard ordinance was first enacted, when there's a lot of interest in it, and when it first got in place, we were probably up around 45, 48, maybe 50, and then it slowly tapered off. And numbers have gone up and down. I mean, I can remember times when we've had probably more than 50 liveaboards, and we were struggling with getting them all permitted, and then the liveaboard numbers shrink down, and people move off, do other things, move on. The numbers go down. We're kind of at a low point right now. We're in the low to mid-20s, so...
Okay, and given what you said, that at one point in time there was an effort to try to have them renew at a particular point in time, I presume for efficiency's sake, is there a group renewal coming up?
Yeah, they run by fiscal year now. So they run from July 1st to June 30th over a two-year stretch. So they're all roughly spread out over two. You know, we got about half one year and half the next because we were – having them, you know, they would run for a 1 year period whenever the person got the inspection and got their final sign off, and they were all over the calendar, and it was hard to keep track of, you know, 20 to 40 permits that were all over the calendar and keep on top of notifying them and making sure they're current on billing and everything else. So and that was part of that liveaboard committee, was make them on a 2 year cycle and make them expire at the same time, which is basically the end of June. So come May, June, which is coming up, we're starting to look at the files and notify folks and get into the files and get ready for a big renewal effort.
Do you happen to know tonight how many at the end of June are coming up for renewal?
No, but I would hazard a guess probably about half of that in mid-20s, so anywhere from probably, you know, 10 to 15.
At one time?
Gene.
Who in the city makes a determination about who is a qualified surveyor?
According to the ordinance, it says, I don't know if it says harbor director, but it just says harbor department. According to the ordinance, it's the city. Acceptable to the city.
What does that mean?
The city.
And further, it doesn't really define qualified. I mean, a qualified marine surveyor acceptable to the city. So what is there's no definition of qualified there.
No, and I will bear one of our soft underbellies in all of our municipal code, and especially in our harbor section. We're very light on definitions and they are due for an updating, because you look at more robust municipal codes and there's 28 pages of definitions per section that define everything, and we don't have a lot of good definitions.
So here's what I'd like to do at this point, because I see maybe a fork in the road here for us, where perhaps we may want to reconvene a liveaboard committee to address some of these issues, or we can talk about any specific things that we'd like Eric to take a look at and maybe come back to us down the road on. However, we've had some discussions, lots of questions. We do have members from the public here. With the indulgence of the board, I would like to reopen public comment now that we've had this discussion. Is there any objection to that? Okay, because we're here for you folks, and we want to carry out your will as best we can for the benefit of everybody on the Bay. So at this point, we will reopen public comment. Is there anyone here from the public that would like to address this issue? If so, please come forward. State your name, city of residence. If you're a liveaboard, it would help, too, if you stated that, and we would love to hear your thoughts.
Hello. My name is Drew Jacobson. I am the surveyor that you're discussing. I have done 26 liveaboard permits out of 32 permits. I believe the city has done six of them. Excuse me. Also, this issue, Eric mentioned that this issue had not been brought up between the city about seaworthiness, operability, those words. I disagree. A year ago, I was called in by Eric and Mr. Rob Schultz, and we had a discussion of this, among other things. I gave them my opinion that the city has liability issues on that language of the ordinance, and that should be changed, and I didn't understand why the city allowed itself to take that liability. As with me, I would also be called into court if there was a lawsuit. Although, understand, the city has the final say. The city, has the final say on who is permitted. I do not. I can only give my opinion of a questionnaire. That's what I do. And this issue, again, was brought up with Mr. Schultz, and I was told not to say anything more. And I'm happy to see you're discussing it now. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Any other comments? Please come forward.
My name is Denise Jacobson. I have the same problem that my husband has. I just wanted to let everyone know, the impression I'm getting is that no one seems to know where Drew came from and how he's determining to sign these. The Harbor Department's referring people to him. We're constantly getting calls saying, Becca told us to call you. The Harbor Department told us to call you. So I'm not quite sure why now there is this. I'm getting the feeling that they're saying we have no idea who Drew is or where these information came from. So I just wanted to clear that up. Thank you.
Thank you, Denise.
About things like this when there's
Steve, please.
In this city,
please come on up.
Be addressed. I swear, you guys are just too much.
Anyone else for public comment?
Really?
No.
For real?
Steve, I need you to contain yourself, please. Anyone else for
what about all the people any on
Stephen?
The boats,
Stephen.
The fishing boats and all up and down the harbor that
Stephen.
I should look the other way on.
Anyone else for public comment?
Hi, my name is Rich Bourne. We live on the vessel Third Day with our two teenage kids that go to Morro Bay High. And we moved aboard, when was it there?
August.
In August. So we've been here not as long as some of the others, but I just wanted to make the comment that we've had very good experiences here in Morro Bay with the other liveaboard community and the harbor office. We've had very good, I think, communications with them in terms of asking questions, going in, and when the harbor boat goes by and checks us out, I work from a board, so I'm pretty much a board all day long. So I see them making their rounds, I see them checking the moorings, and it is appreciated as a liveaboard, and I think they do a pretty good job of looking after things and looking after us out there.
Thank you, Rich.
We're an asset in the Bay. We're an eye on the Bay. We are good people on the Bay.
Thank you, Steve. Anyone else for public comment? Okay, public comment is hereby closed. Thank you, each and every one of you, for those comments. We appreciate it. So, board members, we need to decide where to go from here with this issue. Two avenues that I see. One is reconvening the ad hoc committee to talk about the certification issue and any other refinements that need to be made in the ordinance relative to the liveaboard issue. Or we could give Eric some specific input tonight on the issue. Or anything else that you see as board members that we need to, any other avenues that you see tonight. But those are two possibilities that I see for us. Thoughts from board members with regard to that, please. Yes, Bill.
I don't think there's a big problem. I think that we just need to define a couple things. I mean, Becca, if you read here, she has three recommendations, or really two. She'd like to basically, when you do the certification, is to actually have the discharge being able to be utilized as opposed to, say, you just have a porta potty. And then two, maybe allow fishermen to live on their vessels when they're fishing and to be classified as a liveaboard. As opposed to the marine surveyor, whether or not they do it or the harbor, I don't think it really matters. I mean, whoever does it according to how the city wants it being done, and then the boat owner has the choice of who they want to go to. It's real simple. I don't think there's really a major issue here. But if we want to reconvene, I mean, I'd raise my hand and meet with Becca and go over some of the language. I have no problem in doing that if we need to fine-tune some of the things. The seaworthiness thing does concern me. I don't know how to address it, though. I mean, I really don't.
Thank you, Bill. Gene?
I like the liveaboards, and I have absolutely no problem at all doing the inspections. I just need some more clarification on what we're really dealing with here. So
Eric, let me ask you, is this something that you feel that with what you've heard tonight from the board and members of the public that you could go back and do some work on this and take a look and maybe come back with some language or some suggestions for council that you'd like to run by the board first a month or two down the road? Or is it something that you think is worthy of the board reconvening a committee so that we could address it more in depth and then come back to you in the first place with some recommendations?
Well, we know, I mean, either way. I mean, I'm fine either way. I mean, you know, the liveaboard committee we had before dealt with a lot of issues. You know, we've got a few here and a couple others in terms of, you know, fishermen and liveaboards on piers. I mean, that's one of our concerns because they're not supposed to be living on the pier now, and it's difficult to not have fishermen living on the pier, and maybe time to relook at that. You know, I'd want to just speak out more to Steve out here than anybody. You know, we're not trying to crank down or get rid of liveaboards. I mean, I was a liveaboard too, as you well know, and I totally support liveaboards. They're a force out on the bay that belong out there, and they're good. You know, the ordinance is the ordinance, and we've got to deal with it, and we have a duty to regulate liveaboards on a bunch of different levels that I'm not going to go into for tonight's discussion. But there's some bumps in the road with the ordinance, and we're just trying to iron some of them out. So, you know, I hope you're not getting the impression that we're trying to eliminate liveaboards, because that's the last thing we're trying to do. Drew, if you don't mind me...
Steve, we'll need some order from the gallery, please.
If you don't mind me indulging the board here a bit, Drew, I stand corrected. I mean, you're right. You and I and Rob and Denise, we did sit down and talked about some of those things we talked about with operability and seaworthiness. I had forgotten about it. I stand corrected. As far as Denise, your comment about, you know, we act like we don't know who you are. We know who you are. I mean, yeah, people... understand now that it's not us that have to always do the inspections, that there's other options out there, and who does inspections? Well, of course we're going to refer them to you. You're the only ones out there that we know of that are doing them. So I don't quite know where that comment comes from, but back to your question, Jeff.
you know, I'm happy to try and look at some of these things with any kind of comments that the board wants to give me and hearing what I've heard from the public tonight, and bring something back and see if we want to then put the committee together or not and see if we've got enough information from there. You know, a lot of it, I think, is, as we spoke, is definitions. We don't have a lot of clear definition. As Ron spoke, you know, we've got some inconsistencies in the ordinance that kind of don't match with each other from one end of the ordinance to the other. And then there's the whole legal issue. You know, we've got new legal counsel, and I don't know that he's got any harbor or liveaboard experience. Probably not too many that do, but I'd be very curious to hear what our legal counsel would have to say about the whole liveaboard inspection program and what it means when we put some sort of a stamp or sign a paper that gives somebody a liveaboard ordinance that's supposed to comply with certain operational and seaworthiness standards. Maybe time for that to really be looked at heavily.
I would feel very comfortable with that process, with Eric going back and discussing with his staff, Becca and his other staff members, and then coming back down the road with any changes or suggestions and getting our input at that time. And then I would also state to members of the public, we're here for you. We're here to represent you. This is an open format. I'm grateful that we live in a place where we can do this in an open format. I know it is an emotional issue as well, because if you're a liveaboard, we're talking about your home. So I know that each and every one of us up here are sensitive.
Make sure everything's clear. Thank you.
Yes, Alan.
Yeah. I am a former liveaboard and totally 100% behind living aboard. I wanted to say to Eric, on the fishermen living on their boats at the T Pier, we in the Morro Bay Fishermen's Organization really feel that transients don't have any other place to tie up. And a fisherman who's living on his boat in the course of fishing during his regular season, we feel like he should get an automatic exemption from the whole liveaboard program.
Which, you know, there is. I mean, that was factored in when the ordinance was crafted. The allowance there, and whether it's an adequate amount of time or not, I guess it depends on the season and the fishery. You can live aboard your vessel in Morro Bay Harbor for up to 60 days without having to have a permit, and that was the clause that was put in just specifically for fishermen coming in town on a transient basis knowing they're not residents. Is 60 days enough? Maybe in some cases, maybe in some not. I guess, like I say, it depends on the fishery and the season. The pier, you know, there's a prohibition in the liveaboard ordinance for liveaboards on either the T piers or in the anchorage. My understanding of the pier prohibition was it was a liveaboard on the South T Pier that started the electrical fire back in 1989 or 90, and the liveaboard ordinance came shortly after that, and I believe the prohibition on the piers was, and two people died in that occurrence, and that was a huge incident for the city. I think when the liveaboard ordinance came hot on the heels of that, the emotions were high, and folks were paranoid about liveaboards on the piers and fires starting on the pier again. So I think that's where that came from. I think, you know, having had, you know, 10, 15 years of hindsight on it now, we've had, as I can think of, at least two incipient fires on our piers that were put out by basically liveaboard commercial fishermen on the pier. They got there first because they saw it, because they're there all the time. And I think, you know, one of the things that we'd like to look at is, you know, some kind of an allowance for qualified commercial fishermen, you know, maybe a limited number on the piers to allow for that, because it's a enforcement challenge for us now, because we get non-fishermen on the piers that are living board and are not supposed to, but it's tough to enforce on them because we've got fishermen that are living board on the piers too, and they're, you know, they're on working boats, and we're kind of caught in this catch-22, so that's one of the things we'd like to look at.
Yeah, okay, my interest is, whenever I'm fishing elsewhere, I'm in that category of somebody who's gone to another harbor, and I want to be able to stay on my boat, which is my base operations, while I'm working.
Yeah. So, I mean, everybody is. I mean, everybody that comes to town from somewhere else, they're mostly living on their boat.
The problem in Morro Bay is that if you're a transient, you're not going to get a slip necessarily right off the bat, and you're going to be stuck at the T pier. So.
Other comments or direction for, or request for direction to Eric with regard to this subject?
Eric, given that there's a little bit less than 90 days before a fairly significant number of permits come up for renewal, is there anything other than the process that you and Jeff have just discussed, is there anything that the Harbor Advisory Board or any of its members can do to assist you?
Well, I'm always open to individual input, and if you want to come in and groups are, obviously you can't violate the Brown Act, but I'm always open to information and input from any one or all of you. I mean, that's a given all the time on any issue. Certainly on some of these issues, yeah, absolutely. If you can, if we want to meet and talk and go over some of the issues, I'm more than happy to take any kind of input and help I can get.
All right, so does that sound like a good game plan moving forward? Ask Eric, we would ask of you or request of you that you take a look at this, and I know that you're extremely busy as it is, but if you could take a look at this and come back to us sometime in the future with the review of it and maybe some suggestions for changes that you gathered with your staff and then asked us for our input.
Yeah,
does that sound fair?
Delegation comes to mind. Yeah, and Ron makes a good point. I mean, we've got a slug of them coming up, and this is April. You know, it'd be good to bring them back. You know, maybe if we can get something back here by the May meeting, but maybe more likely shoot for the June meeting because they're expiring. And like any renewal, most people wait to the bitter end, and sometimes go over. So we're probably into the later part of June that folks are going to be coming in earnest about it. So getting it to you by June would probably be our goal.
Okay. So that concludes item C1. Moving on to item D on the agenda, new business. There is no item D. We have no new business to take care of tonight, which takes us to item E, declaration of future agenda items. Eric always has his pending list, and that's a good place for us to start for future agenda items. And while he's doing that, board members, you can think if you have any that you can bring up afterwards. So, Eric, do you have some items on your future pending list there that you can review for us, although we've tackled a lot of them over the last couple of months?
Yeah, let me look at the minutes here as well. Leaning on Polly here too. Pongas, we got Coast Guard building location. Not a lot of activity there, but it could come back if we had to. Planning for the power plant property. I think we're looking at recommending to the council to reconvene that new futures group and see if anything could happen there. I know the power plant is definitely closing now and they're starting to tear things apart a little bit, but I don't know of any activity per se going on that's planning for any of the properties that's worth bringing up. I see Harbor Department budget in May. That's coming up. I've recently been working on that and submitting all my stuff up to Susan Slayton up in finance, so that would be a good one to bring back in May. And Ron, you had a ton of questions related to budget and capital, which is all kind of tied together the last meeting. So those would be some good ones. And that could take a fair amount of time. And if we can get the liverboard to back on, that would be maybe another too late of a meeting. But those ones we can certainly look at bringing back.
Okay. Is there anything that Eric just mentioned, board members, that you'd like to see sooner as opposed to later? No? Okay. And of course, he and I work together to prioritize those as time allows and as urgency dictates. Yes, Ron?
Did I understand correctly or incorrectly that relative to the budget and its associated issues, the activities that are embedded in it, that will be on the next agenda? Or did I not understand that correctly?
I had it tentatively on for May. I think when we brought it up a meeting or two ago,
okay,
we tentatively mentioned it for May because that's about the time we're starting to drill down on the budget.
Okay. A declaration of future agenda items by board members? I don't see any to my left. Any over here to my right? Yes, Ron?
Alan, do you think that for the April meeting that That for the May meeting that the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization, its polling of its members relative to public buying, will that have concluded itself, and should that be on the agenda or not be on the agenda at that time?
We can put it on the agenda, yeah, and the responses to our survey are coming in as far as who would use the public sales dock and who would use the cold storage, and there is a definite positive response to both those items. There are a significant number of responses that say, don't, you know, do anything that would interfere with the boatyard. So I'm not sure whether we really want to bring that up or not, but those are items in the consensus. Maybe we could wait and see what the City Council does with adopting the other, what's the name of that plan?
The Morro Bay Fishing Community Sustainability Plan.
Yeah, that one. And then if the council adopts that and wants to go ahead, then we will have a survey ready at the May meeting, the responses to a survey, and we'll tell you what we think we need.
So if that's done, what I would ask as chair is that you get a hold of Eric or myself get a hold of Eric and let him know that it's done, and then we could schedule that under public hearings, reports, and appearances, item B.
And would I give him the finished report on what the survey results were? Okay, yeah, I'll give it to Eric.
Yeah, all right. It might dovetail nicely because Polly made out a nice future agenda from the March meeting too that I just pulled back out, and public fish buying dock and cold storage were two of the things that you brought up in March that I hadn't written on my own list yet, but depending on what happens Tuesday with that plan, it's all kind of flowing together in the same direction. It'd be a good time to bring that back if the council gives us some direction on certain things to pursue.
Yeah, there were other items in the sustainability report, and we decided to limit ourselves to just considering a few at once, and whether even more than one is too many.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Moved by Bill, seconded by Alan. All in favor, please say aye. All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for a good meeting.